I made the drive up from Los Angeles. I really, really owe a debt of gratitude to this meeting. When I found this meeting for the first time, I went through and listened to all the speakers on the website, and they helped a lot. Some of them in particular stuck with me to this day, one or two in particular, and I won't quote them, but suffice it to say that this meeting is very instrumental in my recovery, and that's why I keep coming back up here from LA, and I'm just glad that I can do this tonight. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I don't know what's going to come up. I purposefully did not make a plan because I just want to be guided by something bigger than myself, and I do believe that will happen as long as I'm willing to get out of the way. I have been in this program for 4.5 years. I started in the quote-unquote mother program, but even before that, the path was in place for me to end up in the rooms of recovery. I grew up in a pretty severely dysfunctional family. I know that I am not unique in that regard. There, however, was no alcoholism or addiction in my family, and I think that's really worth noting for anyone in here who may be wondering if this is the right place for them, if they don't relate to that portion of it. I didn't either. I grew up in a Mormon family, so I had a very pretty strict religious upbringing, and there was no alcohol or drugs of any kind, and there was zero tolerance for it. And there was also a very strong sense of shame in the household I grew up in, and repression. And there was the rules of don't talk, don't trust, don't feel were very much in place in my family of origin. While it was unstated, it was certainly felt on a cellular level. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. My parents, I've come to find out that they were not right for each other in any way, which I do think my story starts before I was even really born. My parents were totally mismatched. My mother agreed to marry a man that she did not want to marry for the sake of her family because they were all telling her that this was the right and proper thing to do. She was a Mormon girl and she was going to marry a Mormon boy. She was in love with a Catholic boy and her parents weren't having that. So even before I showed up on the scene, there was a sense of duty first to anyone but yourself. Duty to an institution, and the institution will dictate how you're supposed to conduct your life. And even when it comes down to the most important decisions one can make, like the partner that you're going to choose to have children with. And I came to find that out more recently, in recent years, but it makes a lot of sense. You know, it puts things into perspective. And more than anything else these days, I just want the truth, you know, because the truth puts me more in touch with my true self, and I find more and more as I do this work that I'm not afraid of the truth. When the truth comes up and when things are revealed, thanks to this program, I'm able to deal with what comes up. And I have a program in place where I don't have to abandon myself, meaning I don't have to run away from the feelings that are coming up as new discoveries are made. That's hugely, hugely important for me to be able to face the truth thanks to this program. My parents divorced very acrimoniously when I was 12 years old. My mother had some pretty severe mental illness that went undiagnosed. We don't know exactly what it is because she's, you know, more or less refused to seek proper treatment. But again, in recent years, I came to find out that when I was a teenager, she was experiencing hallucinations, not unlike somebody with schizophrenia might have, like audible hallucinations, hearing things that weren't there, and was extremely paranoid, and made my father out to be the great persecutor in our lives, and demanded that we treat him as such. There is sexual abuse in my family. My father, again, before I ever showed up on the scene, my father was sexually abused, and he went on to perpetrate the cycle of sexual abuse on my mother's sister around the time that they were to be married, or shortly after they were married, I'm not sure. And again, that piece of information is very kind of crucial to my understanding myself, as someone who has also dealt with a lot of, a lot of dysfunction, a lot of sexual dysfunction, and a lot of trauma, absolutely, around sexuality. And there was not a safe place to discuss those things in the household that I grew up in. And again, it just went unspoken. And the tacit understanding was, you're on your own, you know, figure it out on your own. So as I came into my adolescence, and I started to withdraw further and further and further into myself, at the time when I needed to be coming out of my shell in high school, trying new things, meeting new people. I was withdrawing further and further inside myself. So my mother was explosively angry, and would take out her anger on me and my siblings. I should say that I have two brothers and one sister in my family of origin, and we didn't. Sadly, at the time, there was just. You know, when there's no safe place to go to, when the parents are not to be trusted, unfortunately, I didn't find refuge in my relationships with my siblings either. It became, we each relegated ourselves to one room in the house, and we basically isolated ourselves within the house. I had my room, my younger brother, who I shared a room with for a while, eventually made his basement his room. My older brother had his room, my sister had her room, and we just secluded ourselves. Thankfully, now, as an adult, and in recent years, I've become very, very close to my siblings, especially my sister, and, you know, I'm a witness for her pain, and I'm helping her through her process, and I'm just extremely grateful for that. But at the time, there was no place to go to. And so there are three options when a parent is in your face in a rage, screaming at you for not cleaning your room properly. It's fight, flight, or freeze or run within, and I ran within. I became a very classic dissociative. I even found myself up until when I entered AA, I should say ACA, I'm sorry, that's when I started to become more aware of how the dissociative habits that I had were still in place for me. Angry personalities, as it says in our literature, would terrify me, and I would find in those moments when I was around angry people that my head would go real fuzzy. It's like my head's in a fog, and I don't even really know what's going on, because I'm really not there. And my eyes would go down, either to my hands, I fidget with my hands, or stare at the floor, but anything but look you in the face. And that's exactly what I did when I was a kid. There, I was just withdrawing further and further inside myself. My father was gone, so once they split, my dad ended up moving across the country and was in New York while I was in high school. So basically, from the age of 12 to when I was on my own out of the house at 18, there really was not any parenting going on. My mom would... she would oftentimes leave my older brother in charge and take off for a couple of weeks. And then when my older brother left home, it was me who was put in charge. She would leave us some money for food, and then she would take off for a couple of weeks. And I actually, at those times, found it to be a relief because I didn't have to deal with the erratic insanity that that I was constantly accosted with. So... you know, if you had asked me at the time, I would have said that I was happy as could be, and really what I needed was a mother who could show up for me, and a father who could do likewise. That's how it was. I won't dwell too much in that in the past anymore. I'd like to get to the recovery phase, and I did mention that. My recovery journey began in AA. I became, as a result of the lack of parenting and the emotional abuse everything that had come before, I found myself at age 30 entirely disconnected from myself, just completely disconnected from myself. And what does that mean? It means that I ended up bottoming out on alcohol, and the last time I took a drink, I ended up staring at myself in the mirror, kind of in a hysteria of sorts, screaming at myself that I hated myself and that I just wanted to die. So that is what I call being completely disconnected from myself, from my true self. I shortly thereafter began my journey in recovery in AA. I stayed there for about 7 years, and I'm going to talk about my story in that program, and it's not going to be like everybody else's story, but it is my story. And I'm going to break the rules here tonight, don't talk, I'm going to talk, I'm going to give my opinion, and that's all it is, it's my opinion. The thing that I've realized is there are as many paths to recovery in the rooms of 12-step rooms as there are individuals there. I honor anyone's path through recovery in these rooms. My journey had to come to an end in AA because there were certain modes of thinking that were going to keep me sick. And that's for me personally. It's not a criticism. I'm not trying to be provocative. That's not my intention. My intention is to be honest and to tell my story and to say the thing that's difficult, because my kid, my inner child, gets so scared when he feels like he's saying something wrong, you know. My kid needs to know that he can share his opinion, whatever it is, whatever it is. He is allowed to do that, and I'm giving him permission right now. So, my journey took me away from AA. There were certain things that did not work for me, and if I chose to keep trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, so to speak, then I was going to prevent my stepping into my true self. So what that looks like for me is the popular thinking of you can't trust your mind. Your mind is what the problem is. Don't trust your mind. I can't get better if I can't learn to trust myself. It's not possible for me. So I had to leave that behind. I still don't think it's a good idea for me to take a drink, and it's never interested me, you know, even in the time that I've spent away from AA. it still has not interested me in the least. And I have been firmly planted in this program ever since. And it's actually served me really well. I have made so many discoveries in the program of ACA, and as soon as I found this program, the floodgates were open. The only reason that I'm not probably up here bawling tonight is that I've done plenty of it already. My first six meetings, there is something about, like they say, the first six meetings, because for me, I cried from start to finish of my first six meetings. It was the six, and then something like happened after the sixth, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. But I sat down, the meeting began, and more or less for those six meetings, I just started crying and couldn't stop until the end of the meeting. So that signified to me that clearly I was in the right place. I have worked the steps through in ACA, and it was a drastically different process than working them in AA. I specifically, coming to the amends portion, I was relieved to find out that I really had done all my amends in the first program. You know, because I was I had gotten to a point where I was just looking for, trying to dig up like some experiences in my past where I was wrong so that I could go make more amends. And thankfully, it finally hit me, and I finally came to the realization, thanks to working with a sponsor and thanks to starting to develop a trusting relationship with my higher power, it was made pretty clear to me, like, no, you're done. You're done making your amends, you know? I'm not the type of person who goes out of my way to take advantage of people. That's never been me, and I'm glad to know that now. And I don't have to look for ways to make myself wrong, you know, just because I'm told, you know, that I am. You know, I've done my amends, which is so great. By the time I made it to step 9 in this program, I had two amends left. One's probably going to have to be a living amends, because I don't know how I can ever find that individual. And the most important amends that I had yet to make, and I think it is, for me, it's the most important amends of all, is to myself. And in my case, it was not one singular amends to be made. It was multiple times. I found myself going through the yellow workbook, and all of those things that I was inventorying, you know, the common logic was, if you have a resentment, then there's an amends to be made. Not necessarily at all. I found that that I'm angry and I'm frustrated because things, unjust things had happened to me. And the amends that I needed to make was to myself at that age. And so there were many, many, many instances where I sat down and wrote to myself, to the boy that I was at that time. And more or less the language of each of these amends was, you couldn't have done anything else. It was not your fault. If you could have done better, you would have. You absolutely would have. And I still use these tools to this day. Like, I'm talking about, like, you know, if I'm kicking myself about something that I did a month ago, the same thing applies. If I could have done better at that time, I would have. I really do believe that's true. And this process has been one of finding my true self, absolutely. And it's awakened, it has awakened a relationship with my inner child. And when I first was presented with the idea of an inner child, it was in a group therapy setting, And I was very new to recovery, and the whole concept felt weird and alien and just bizarre to me. I didn't know how to talk to this kid. I didn't know what the hell I was supposed to say. Essentially, it felt like I was being tasked with being a parent, and all the while feeling I'm totally ill-equipped to be a parent. I have not had the proper role models for this. So what I've found out is that my kid, more often than not, really just wants to be heard. That's all. He just wants to be listened to. He wants to be validated. I sat down 2 days ago. I've taken up playing drums, and it's been great, and it's been frustrating, because it puts me right back to when I was a kid taking piano lessons, and just I found the whole thing so frustrating that I wasn't immediately good, that it took so much time and effort. And I sat in front of the drum kit 2 days ago, and I started to get frustrated, and then I started to hear two different voices speaking, and the one that was frustrated was my kid. And he was like, this is so hard. And I felt myself trying to be pulled into the voice of the frustration and identify with it. And instead, what I decided to do was talk to the voice of frustration and acknowledge it and say, you're right, this is hard. This is really difficult. You know, you have four limbs each doing something independent of each other. It's ridiculously difficult. And I am so proud of you for sticking with it for a year. You're absolutely right. This is hard, you know, and the frustration started to subside, you know, and you know that's what the inner child work looks like for me these days. The voices in my head are starting to, well, first off, there really are only two. It's my kid and it's me as an adult now. You know, and I was talking to my kid, has been with me for the last 3 days, which is kind of incredible because I haven't spent that much time with him in, well, ever, since making conscious contact with him. And he was with me on the ride up. He was with me right before the meeting, and he's freaking out. And I'm like, hey, you don't have to worry about anything. I have to do the hard stuff. You get to sit down and you can check out and don't even listen to me if you don't want to. Right? I'll take care of this. You know, because the adult me knows that I can do this, right? The child doesn't. And so the child just needs to be reassured, you know? And so that's what I do. I reassure him. And they're like, I got this. You can go play. You can do whatever you want. And I don't know. Something's happening because these last 3 days have been amazing. I went to... again, it was the same day, 2 days ago. I went to get some lunch, and my kid was like, I don't want to eat here. And I had already ordered my food. And I was like, you know what? Let's leave, you know? Like, just because we ordered our food does not mean we have to sit here and wait and pay for it. And I just left, and I went somewhere. My kid wanted to sit outside, so we sat outside. And we didn't, you know, he didn't want to be around crowds and didn't want to wait. And so we went somewhere where there were no crowds, and we didn't wait. And then he wanted ice cream, so we went and got an ice cream. And I was walking out of this ice cream shop, and I must have just been beaming, because I heard a girl sitting at a table as I walked out going, that guy looks really happy to be having that ice cream. And I sat down, and I just went, you should get one. And 5 minutes later, she got up and went inside and got herself one. So I thought that was pretty cool. And you know, I've suddenly jumped to like current, to like today, and that's okay. I can backtrack a little bit. I would like to backtrack a little bit. I would like to talk about there was, even after I finished my step work in this program, I didn't know it, but there was still something missing. I have also sought outside help in order to recover from the effects of PTSD. became pretty fully aware that that's what I was dealing with when I guess I was about 2 years into this program, and I went to a PTSD-focused ACA meeting in Los Angeles. And I, in the format, I heard symptoms of PTSD being read, and two of them jumped out at me. And this is going to get heavy again, fair warning. But two of the symptoms that I heard were, or maybe even three, one of which was there's a fundamental belief that you will never marry. There is a fundamental belief that you will never have the type of career that you would like to have. And there's a fundamental belief that you will live a shortened lifespan. And I went, holy crap, that's check, check, and check. I got all of those. And I think when I heard that for the first time, I thought that what I was dealing with was post-traumatic stress disorder. And then that pretty much solidified it for me, confirmed it for me. And so I've been seeking outside help to deal with the effects of PTSD. And if anyone doesn't know if that's what they're dealing with, I can describe my experience, and maybe it'll resonate with you, maybe it won't. But I have had full-on PTSD episodes after certain experiences. Most of them relate to my being willing to use my voice. That's when the symptoms come on the strongest for me. And I, about 3 weeks ago, was in an ACA meeting in Los Angeles, shared that I don't agree with everything that I hear in the rooms of 12-step. And again, my child went, oh my God, we're going to get in trouble. You know, mom is going to scream at us, or we're going to get smacked in the face, or we're letting down our religion or whatever, you know, the old stuff. And I was willing to have an opinion that differed from others, because I never had that when I was a child. I didn't get an opinion of my own, you know. I didn't get to express. I didn't fight with my parents. All the while this was going on, you know, the abuse that I'm suffering at home, I didn't fight. I didn't ever scream or raise my voice at my mother. I didn't say a contrary thing. And my kid gets to do that now. And I trust myself now to know that I won't use my anger I won't use other people as a scapegoat for my anger. I'm not afraid of my anger. That's why I'm not afraid of my anger, because I don't use other people as scapegoats for my anger. I know who I'm angry at, and I know why. I get to have my anger. I get to express my anger, especially here. And I find that incredibly liberating. I found a sponsor who allowed me to use my own words. I started working with an individual who didn't allow me that. When I began to talk about the experiences that I'd been through, he, in a gentle way, but did silence me. And that's just not going to work for me, you know. I have to be able to speak and speak in my own words, whatever those words are, expletives, whatever. I stopped working with that individual and found the sponsor that was right for me, that was willing to bear witness to my pain. And my pain is only expressed in my own language, with my own words. If he had felt that you know, my expressing my anger, my rage, if he had ever felt uncomfortable, I knew that he would speak up for himself and say as much. But he never did, which was so, again, just validating that I really needn't fear my anger. It's amazingly, I don't explode on people. I don't know how that happened, because I certainly had an example of that. I believe that I retained some part of my true self. Some part of my true self made it through that, you know, that horrendous upbringing unscathed. And that's the part that that doesn't take his anger out on other people. So I'm so grateful to have found that that sponsor, and that's when things started to really shift. When I was willing to say the thing that I didn't want to say. That when I was willing to break the unwritten rule, don't talk, don't have an opinion of your own, just conform. I can't conform and recover personally. I can't. This is a personal experience that I'm having. My relationship to my higher power is between me and my higher power and nobody else. Not even my sponsor, but I trust his opinion. I trust his judgment, but has nothing to do with him either. And I think that's beautiful. I love that. Because I feel now that I am having my own experience. I'm not living somebody else's experience or living someone else's expectations of what my journey through recovery is supposed to look like. And I've somehow found the courage to be confrontational. And it's not about, again, it's not about being provocative, but I gotta be willing to differ. And honor my differences. That's the other thing. It was hammered into me. Look for the similarities, not the differences. And that served me for a time. Now I look for both. Both serve me well. I look for the similarities. I also look and honor the differences that I have. And I say, you know, that doesn't work for me, and that's okay. You know. And so I'm finding it to be a much more integrative experience now. It's not so black and white. It's not only similarities, not the differences. It's every part of my experience now has a purpose and serves me well. The other part of this that was missing up until very recently was missing because I wasn't aware of it. And it took some outside literature, and if you're all curious, I have some things I can recommend after the meeting. I won't do it here since this is a 12-step meeting and this is being recorded. So I will just keep the, I'll keep the focus on 12-step. But suffice it to say that a series of books really, really opened my eyes to the ways in which I was still protecting my parents. And that was never the role I was supposed to play. I was supposed to be protected. And I find myself as an adult protecting my parents' feelings, and I recognize that that is going to keep me stuck. Last summer, let me check the time real quick. Oh boy, oh, I gotta wrap it up, good. Last summer I was back visiting my dad. My father, I have been over the years attempting to educate my parents as to the effects of trauma, PTSD, and depression. What growing up in that household has meant for me and my siblings as an adult. I considered past tense, and these are my words, a bridge of understanding between my parents and my siblings. I do not think that way anymore. I found myself last summer when my father said to me, your sister, when she's here, she treats me like I'm not even in the room. I found myself a year ago trying to explain to him again the effects of trauma. Essentially trying to explain to him why he doesn't have a better relationship with his daughter. And only very recently did I discover that that is not my role to play. I can't fix his relationship with his daughter. It's not my responsibility. The only thing that makes any sense for me to say to him is, sounds like you're having a hard time recognizing that you have a part in this, Dad. That's it. That's the end of my responsibility toward him when things of that nature arise. And I have told him as much too. And that's another instance where I, over the phone, basically recounting that experience from last summer again, I said, this is what I could have said. I could have said, wow, Dad, it sounds like you're having a hard time recognizing that you have a part in this. And as I say this, I'm shaking, you know, and my body is vibrating, my fingertips are going numb, my jaw is tingling, and there's a numbing sensation in my jaw, there's a heaviness in my chest and a coldness, and I know that I'm having another PTSD episode, but I recognize what is happening, and I move through the fear anyway, and I open my mouth and I speak through the fear. Kind of experiencing them a little bit right now. But I don't have enough time to go through a whole episode here for you, so. That is a miracle. I am saying the things that I was never able to say because I wasn't given a voice. I have a voice today. I can use it, and I can use it where it counts, with my parents. That's where it counts the most. And I can draw boundaries with them and say, that's not my responsibility. It's not my responsibility to take care of your feelings and protect you, you know? That's what I deserved when I was young. And I'm giving it to myself now. Yeah. Feels like the ending point, right? That's it. Thank you.
All right.
Wow. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us. How about another round of applause? That was just thank you. Okay. Do we need to end? Thank you.
And now I'd like to thank all of those who've taken part tonight to make this meeting happen. John.